Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day. Are you a passionate surgical educator with something to say? Then join Behind the Knife and let the world hear. Behind the Knife is the number one surgery podcast in the world, with each episode reaching 20,000 listeners. Our current group of subspecialty teams have created incredibly diverse and engaging content, but their commitments are nearly finished, and we want to open up the opportunity to all of our listeners. We're looking for teams of 3 to 4 surgeons who will develop one new subspecialty podcast every 4 months. To learn more, check out the show notes or contact us at hello@behindtheknife.org. Applications are due February 13th.
Okay, welcome to Behind the Knife podcast. Today we're going to discuss intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. As usual, I'll introduce my colleagues. Dr. Caitlin Hester is an assistant professor of surgery in the Division of Surgical Oncology at the University of Miami in the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Gilbert Marimwa is a research resident right now and a PGY3 surgical resident at the University of Texas Southwestern. I'd like to welcome both of you to the podcast. So today we're going to be discussing the workup and intraoperative thought process for patients who present with intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. I guess we'll get started right away with you, Gilbert. And how do these patients typically present or commonly present with ICC or intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma?
Yeah, thanks for the introduction. So although intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma is the second most common primary cancer of the liver, and it originates in the intrahepatic biliary system, patients with ICC rarely present with symptoms consistent with obstructive jaundice, including pruritus, jaundice, and acolic stools. Unfortunately, the patient's symptoms are often indolent and nonspecific, oftentimes leading to delayed diagnosis in many cases and 5-year overall survival rates that are less than 10%.
Yeah, and I think that's a key point. A lot of the times we're seeing these patients in clinic who present essentially with just imaging done for another reason. So Caitlin, after you have kind of a suspicion that you have a patient in your clinic who presents with a liver mass and typically can be for totally another reason and asymptomatic, that your concern is the patient has an intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, walk us through what your thought process, and especially it's interesting as you're a new faculty or a new surgical oncologist, what's your thought process and how you work up these patients?
I think the most important first step is to obtain really good quality axial imaging of the abdomen and pelvis. Whether that be CT or MRI, I think that's dealer's choice, but you need really good contrasted imaging using multiphase axial images. The role of imaging in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma is twofold. One, it gives further insight into the tumor characteristics and can differentiate hepatocellular cancer versus intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma based on arterial enhancement and washout patterns. And two, it allows determination of resectability based on the location of the lesion within the liver and also multifocality. In addition, since intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma is oftentimes a diagnosis of exclusion, it is important to evaluate for a primary malignancy, including colorectal cancer, gastric cancer, or other HPV malignancies. Along those lines, typically, most patients will undergo both lower and upper endoscopy. In addition to imaging, including a chest CT for extensive staging workup, tumor markers such as CA19-9, CEA, and AFP are oftentimes sent as part of the staging workup.
Yeah, and I think it's really a diagnosis of exclusion when you're trying to work these patients up. A little bit of a controversial question, and what is kind of the role of biopsy? We obtain biopsies in a lot of solid organ tumors, but when you're having a high suspicion of a patient having intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, what's the role of a biopsy?
So a preoperative biopsy is not always necessary, especially if there's a single localized tumor, non-multifocal tumor, that is a potential candidate for curative resection in the proper clinical setting. However, I do think if there's multifocality or evidence of disease not amenable to surgical resection, I think a biopsy is prudent.
So once there's a more certainty of the diagnosis of intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, either that's a biopsy, which typically will come back frustratingly as is just a pancreatic biliary malignancy. So once you have that biopsy results, or you have an additional clinical picture, especially the axial imaging, as I'll describe to people, it looks more like cauliflower within the actual imaging pictures themselves. It's really, I think we can put these patients into three distinct categories, or probably two distinct categories, folks with or patients that present with resectable disease. And then I think you can lump together patients with unresectable disease or metastatic disease. So let's delve into each or the two major categories one at a time. And Gilbert, in a patient that you think has resectable intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, is there any role for neoadjuvant therapy, which seems to be very hot in HPV malignancies?
Yeah, so although neoadjuvant therapy for resectable HPV malignancies is a hot topic right now for clinical trials, it's not the standard of care for patients who have resectable intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. A recently presented study, the NeoGAP, was reported demonstrating that patients with resectable ICC with high-risk features, including tumor size greater than 5 centimeters, multifocality, presence of major vascular invasion, or regional lymphadenopathy, who received triplet gemcitabine, cisplatin, and nab-paclitaxel prior to their resection, had a partial response rate of 27%, and the disease control rate was 90%. So unfortunately, due to the relatively low amount or paucity of ICC cases, it remains to be seen if larger neoadjuvant trials specific to intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma can be carried out to answer this important question.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point. I think if we end up giving neoadjuvant therapy, and it could be that you want to downstage the patient a little bit for a lesser resection, I think you have to know a priori how many cycles you're going to give. Most of us will typically give anywhere between 6 to 8 cycles, so for about 2.5 to 3 months. So you kind of have to know that up front and discuss this in a multidisciplinary nature with your oncologist and usually within some sort of tumor board conference.
I'm going to turn the tables a bit, Dr. Yope. What patients are you treating with neoadjuvant chemotherapy for intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma?
Well, it's, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the patients that we see just because of our nature of our system have already been started on neoadjuvant therapy. So we're usually seeing them after 1 or 2 cycles of neoadjuvant therapy if they're being diagnosed within the community. And then we're seeing them, and then we'll allow them to actually go through the entire 6 to 8 cycles of chemotherapy. If we see a patient up front, typically it's those patients where it may be the difference between doing an extended trisection resection, either an extended right or an extended left hepatectomy, even though the response rates, as Gilbert had said, aren't really that great. So it can be a little bit of a feel more than anything else. I don't think there'll ever be a neoadjuvant trial specifically for ICC. There are currently 3 or 4 trials worldwide, none within the United States, that are actually accruing patients. So it's typically in those patients that where I would call borderline, but borderline's always in the kind of the eye of the beholder. We don't have very simple borderline guidelines like pancreas. So we're in the OR now, presumably with a resectable intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. And I think it's important to kind of determine how we're going to decide on our operative approach. Caitlin, what are you thinking, or can you walk us through an operative approach for a patient that presents with, say, a solitary ICC?
Given the relatively high incidence of finding radiographically occult metastatic disease, I always start these operations with a diagnostic laparoscopy within at the same time as the index operation. Once we confirm there's no evidence of extrahepatic peritoneal disease, I think the tenets of the hepatic resection are similar to other partial hepatectomies. You want to achieve a negative margin resection, and you want to leave adequate future liver remnant. Given that this cohort of patients, unlike patients with hepatocellular cancer, do not have underlying cirrhosis and usually have not received neoadjuvant chemotherapy, leaving a future liver remnant of 30% is perfectly reasonable in this population. And I think that, you know, whatever the surgeon feels most comfortable with regarding technique of resection, whether that's robotically or open, I think both achieve equivalent oncologic outcomes.
Yeah, and I think that's important. Every institution has their kind of their preference for whether they want to do minimally invasive or an open procedure. I think oncologically, they have exactly the same, and that's been demonstrated in multiple other cancer types. So there's no difference, I think, in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. So a little more kind of one easy question maybe, and then one a little more controversial is Kaelin, what are some of the prognostic factors when we get, you know, when we get the specimen back, what are we looking for in the path result that may be associated with survival in this patient population?
Yeah, in multiple retrospective studies, positive margin status, multifocal disease, vascular invasion, and lymph node involvement were all independently associated with decreased survival. Specifically, a margin greater than or equal to 1 centimeter was associated with both improved recurrence-free and overall survival. With regards to routine use of lymphadenectomy during the index operation for resection of intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, I think there's perhaps no bigger controversial topic in HPB surgical oncology. Although lymph node metastases in this cohort of patients approaches 65% in studies, and a lymph node dissection obtaining 6 lymph nodes is recommended by the NCCN, there is a lack of level 1 evidence demonstrating that routine lymphadenectomy either changes the treatment algorithm or improves overall survival. The main benefit appears to be accurate staging, providing patients with reliable prognostic information. And if you remember staging for cholangiocarcinoma, lymph node involvement is considered stage 4A. So typically, we will perform a lymphadenectomy, clearing the entirety of the soft tissue in the porta hepatis, including stations 8 and 12. And then for left-sided ICC, it is important to clear the nodal stations around the gastric cardia and lesser curve of the stomach. And for right-sided tumors, oftentimes the lymphatic drainage can be to the retropancreatic or retroduodenal region.
Yeah, and I think this has really been a paradigm shift over the last 10 years. If you look back at some of the retrospective data, there's still the vast majority of patients undergoing resection for intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma actually don't have a proper lymph node dissection with 6 or greater nodes. And I, you know, as you mentioned, Kaelin, it is an incredibly hot topic. Is this really changing how we're going to treat patients, or is this more just giving more prognostic information for patients on how they will do in the future? It's really kind of unknown at this point. But I think still the standard of care is to do the lymph node dissection. So Gilbert, now that you've done the resection, you've done the partial hepatectomy, you know, you've decided, you bought into the lymph node dissection, and you've completed this, what's next? What are you counseling the patient as far as, you know, patients will want to know, is there a role for me to get further therapy or adjuvant therapy? And what does that consist of?
Yeah, absolutely. So the current recommendation for adjuvant therapy in patients undergoing curative intent resection for intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma is 6 months of chemotherapy, typically consisting of capecitabine.
And I think that's based on the BILCAP trial, or I think most folks will use capecitabine. So can you elaborate a little bit on the findings of the BILCAP trial that led to these recommendations of adjuvant therapy?
Yeah, the BILCAP trial was a randomized phase 3 clinical trial in the United Kingdom. I believe it had 447 patients with cholangiocarcinoma, and they were randomized to either adjuvant capecitabine or surveillance. And although only 19% of the patients were actually intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, there was a significant overall survival benefit in the group that was treated with capecitabine, coming out to 53 versus 36 months. And so thus, it's currently the standard of care for adjuvant therapy. And it's important to note that the use of radiation adjuvant therapy has not shown to offer any benefit in outcomes for these patients.
I do think it's important for this BILCAP study. This survival advantage was only seen in the per protocol cohort. So when you actually look at the intention to treat cohort, the overall survival advantage was not statistically significant.
Yeah, that's incredible. I was just going to mention that's incredibly important to mention. It's amazing that we do treat right now the standard of care and the NCCN guidelines is to give adjuvant capecitabine. However, when you look at it, 19% of the patients out of 447. So you do the math and it works out to be about 80 patients were actually randomized within that trial. So a very small amount of patients, but it was enough. And maybe we're kind of reaching at straws a little bit with the adjuvant therapy. But I think the side effect profile with capecitabine is so low and the benefit may be there that it's worth doing for 6 months. So Gilbert, one last question. And then before we switch gears to non-resectable or metastatic intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, how do you surveil this patient going forward after you've actually done the resection?
So typically we'll image with chest, abdomen, pelvis, axial imaging every 3 to 6 months for 2 years, and then every 6 to 12 months thereafter. So despite a R0 resection, the risk of recurrence intrahepatically and within the lungs remains quite high depending on the biology of the original resection specimen.
Yeah, and I think that's important. I think they typically will recur intrahepatically within the lungs, as you mentioned, and also within the bone. We don't typically do bone scans routinely, but during their history and physical, when we're seeing these patients, we're very cognizant to ask if you're having any lower back pain or rib pain, because it can be the first sign of metastatic disease. So really, for such a nihilistic disease, I think for the first time, there's some recent brightness in the clouds for the patients who present with metastatic or an unresectable intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. Currently, as of the late 2022, there are two current regimens recommended in this cohort of patients. The first one being gemcitabine and cisplatin. And then the second one, the more recent one, was the addition of durvalumab, a PD-L1 inhibitor, to gem-cis. Let's first start talking about the gem-cis regimen and the trial first published in 2010. That led until very recently being the only effective therapy for intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. Caitlin, can you discuss a little bit of the findings from this trial?
So the trial you are referring to is the ABC-02 trial that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2010. Similar to most trials in patients with advanced biliary cancers, they grouped most of the biliary cancers together. And then patients received either gemcitabine alone or combination gem-cis. The median survival was 11.7 months in the combination arm and 8 months in the gemcitabine alone arm, and statistical significance was obtained. Only 80 patients with intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma were included in the study. However, in a subgroup analysis, receipt of combination gem-cis chemotherapy was associated with improved survival compared to gemcitabine alone. This combination has remained the standard of care for patients with advanced or metastatic intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma until recently.
Yeah, and I think that's important. Really, for the first time, the exciting thing is in late 2022, for the first time in over a decade, a new regimen has actually demonstrated efficacy in this cohort of patients. Gilbert, what can you discuss or expound a little bit on the recent TOPAZ-1 trial findings?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, late 2022, the findings of the TOPAZ-1 trial were released, and they demonstrated that adding durvalumab, a PD-L1 inhibitor, in combination with gem-cis was associated with improved overall survival compared to gemcitabine and cisplatin alone.
I remember this got a lot of press when it first came out, and a lot of the Twitterati, so to speak, were very excited by it. But upon reading a little more into it, there are some serious concerns with the findings. Can you talk a little bit more about that, Gilbert?
Yeah, so despite reaching statistical significance, the difference in overall survival between the two groups was actually quite modest. Patients receiving durvalumab in addition to GemCis had a median overall survival of 12.8 months compared to 11.5 months in the GemCis group alone. And given the increase of only 6 weeks in survival, it remains to be seen if the addition of immunotherapy in this group of patients is actually clinically significant. Likely additional trials where patients are selected based on a profile more conducive to response to immunotherapy will improve survival outcomes, and we're eagerly awaiting the results of these trials that should read out in the near future.
Yeah, I think the most important trial that's going to read out, it should read out probably middle of this year or early next year, is the KEYNOTE trial with pembrolizumab, which is another PD-1 or immunotherapy checkpoint inhibitor in this group. So it'll be interesting to see what the results of this trial will be. Really, obviously, the holy grail in all cancer treatment is to find actionable mutations in patients with advanced or unresectable disease, and really, and then target these mutations, this idea of personalized medicine, so to speak. And there's been a fair amount of studies using either next generation sequencing techniques or RNA sequencing that have highlighted the molecular heterogeneity of intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. I think in most studies, about 1 out of 4, 25% of tumors do have actionable mutations. And this really drives home the point or the need for getting a core needle biopsy and then sequencing the tumors in patients with this disease, in this cohort of patients with advanced or metastatic intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma when they're first being diagnosed. Caitlin, I know this is near and dear to your heart with genetic mutations, especially in hepatobiliary cancers. Can you kind of go over the most common actionable mutations and where we stand with some of the targeted agents?
Yeah, I think, you know, more and more academic centers and NIH designated cancer centers are getting biopsies and trying to understand more and more the mutational landscape of these tumors. And I think we're doing this both in the locally advanced and metastatic setting, but also there's a huge drive to really understand even the localized resectable tumors as well. What we do know about intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas and cholangiocarcinomas in general is that most of the mutations mimic other GI tumors. So the most common mutations you're going to see are TP53, KRAS, SMAD4. Usually there's a mutation rate at about 25 to 45% for each of those type of mutations within the cholangiocarcinoma. But I think what's more exciting for the, you know, unresectable and metastatic setting, and then eventually in the resectable setting, is understanding the targetable mutations that are in these tumors. And we know for intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, the most common mutations are FGFR2 and IDH1 among the targetable mutations. FGFR2 occurs at about 10 to 15%. IDH1 is 13%. And then MS microsatellite status is also really important and is targetable and occurs in about 5% of intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas, as well as things like HER2 amplification, which occurs in 5% of intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas, and even a higher extent in gallbladder cancers. And then looking at NTRK fusions and amplifications. And all of these offer the ability to target these specific mutations in these tumors. And as of now, the evidence only allows us to treat these in second line settings. So patients who have gotten first line standard of care treatment who have progressed then can go on to receive these targetable agents in the second line setting. But I think more and more in the future, we'll be seeing these as first line and then eventually, potentially, even in the neoadjuvant setting for these tumors.
That was a great review. That was awesome, Caitlin, on the genetic mutations. I think it's incredibly exciting. I'm excited for both you and Gilbert, as you're kind of both interested in this field and studying the genetic mutations, because I think we're going to make some incredible strides in how we care for patients with intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. So I think we've hit all the highlights. Is there anything else that anybody wants to add to intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma?
I don't think so. I think this has been a great review, and it's been really fun to be back with my SurgeOnc family for this podcast.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I'm just hoping one day that I will be working for either Gilbert or Caitlin as they progress through the world of surgical oncology. Thank you so much for listening, and to Caitlin and Gilbert for working very hard on this.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Have a great time, guys. Thanks.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org for more great content. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please take a minute to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening.
Until next time, dominate the day.